Good afternoon. To start with, I can now reveal for the first time why Dr. Douglas Johnson was invited here. We knew that a student entering the military academy would be here, and we knew one that wanted to enter the Air Force Academy would be here, and we had to give the Naval Academy equal time. Let me start this introduction with a very geographic-specific question for all of you to consider. Is there anything we can do about the anti-Western jihadist content of the curricula in the Islamic madrasa schools in Pakistan? And what about combating the Taliban's efforts to destroy all the girls' schools in Pakistan, in that part of Pakistan where the Pakistani girl Malala Yousafzai was shot by the Taliban? In every madrasa school in Pakistan, the children are required to learn the Quran. A few very bright students learn it by heart in Arabic, even though their native language is Urdu. And the students are usually told to obey the Quran's requirements as interpreted by the imams who teach them. Most of us might throw our arms in the air at this unwieldy challenge and turn to another subject. But Douglas Johnston, my Naval Academy classmate and longtime friend, did not do this. 16 years ago, he founded the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy, or ICRD, whose mission argues for the recognition of the dimension of religion in U.S. foreign policy with nations where that is so central, and that accounting for religion can be part of diplomatic solutions to key geopolitical problems. He'll tell us about that shortly. Let me give you a bit about Doug's background. Doug grew up as a Navy junior. He then attended and graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1960. He and I each had the unique experience of being interviewed by Admiral Hyman Rickover, father of the nuclear submarine program, and we each spent several years in nuclear submarines. At the age of 27, Doug became the youngest officer in submarines to qualify for command. If you've ever seen a nuclear submarine, you would know this was not a trivial achievement. But Doug's interests were broader than commanding a submarine. What Doug eventually created has a far greater conflict deterrent potential than a nuclear missile submarine. So he left the Navy in the 1970s and served in government, including a post as Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy in the Ford administration. He then went to the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, where he became the founder and the first director of the school's executive program in national and international security. While there, he acquired his PhD in political science. 8 years later, he became the chief operating officer of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Doug has authored several books and articles dealing primarily with religion as the missing dimension in foreign policy. His books are worth reading. His 2013 book, Religion, Terror, and Error, provides a unique perspective on religious extremism and suggests what the United States needs to do to deal with it more effectively by adjusting its institutions and procedures. You should read the positive comments about it by former Secretary of State Jim Baker and others. Doug's and my professional paths intersected geographically in the late 1990s when, as I was finishing my 20th trip to Pakistan, Doug was just starting ICRD and would make Pakistan an early focus of his work. Over the past 16 years, ICRD has carried out projects in the Sudan, Kashmir, Iran, Afghanistan, Syria, and Saudi Arabia, as well as Pakistan. Of particular note is ICRD's success in influencing religious leaders to change the curricula in their religious schools called madrasas, to emphasize religious tolerance and human rights, particularly women's rights, and to transform their pedagogy to create critical thinking skills among the students. In Pakistan, the curricula in over 2,000 madrasa schools, including those that gave birth to the Taliban, the curricula has been revised as a result of ICRD's initiatives. Doug has some attention-grabbing stories about ICRD's Pakistan work. And ICRD's work in Saudi Arabia has helped inspire an increase in that country's educational reform budget from $1.5 billion to $22 billion over the next 4 years, with a major focus on teacher training and attitudes regarding world religions. Based on my many trips to Pakistan in the 80s and 90s, I believe that as daunting as ICRD's mission is, it has the potential to be taken to scale and have an even larger impact in the long run. Doug has a lot of faith and a lot of stamina. At the Naval Academy, he was a swimmer and played water polo, a physically demanding and often brutal sport, and the sport at the Academy that supplies most of the Academy graduates that become Navy SEALs. 2 months ago, Doug was the inaugural recipient of the Distinguished Scholar Award in Religion and International Affairs, awarded by the International Studies Association. 4 months before that, Georgetown University sponsored a major event to celebrate the 20th anniversary of his first book called Religion, The Missing Dimension of Statecraft. Doug was cited by a leading journal as the father of faith-based diplomacy, and ICRD has been recognized frequently by the nation's major newspapers. I encourage all of you to check out ICRD. ICRD is politically neutral and relies almost entirely on private donations. You can get on their email list to get monthly updates. They're fascinating, almost without exception. As Doug describes the ICRD concept and experience, I suggest you think about the following premise that he articulates so well in his most recent book, and I quote, "The strong ingrained U.S. ethic of separation of church and state makes our diplomats resist accepting the fact that they must spend time addressing that dimension with nations who do not separate the two." Several experienced U.S. foreign policy experts and diplomats have labeled this as a clear blind spot in U.S. foreign policy and how deadly that can be. General Anthony Zinni, the former head of the U.S. Army Central Command, wrote a foreword to Doug's book, Religion, Terror, and Error, emphasizing how top military and political readers should pay attention to it. For those of you who are interested, Doug will be at a table in the lobby after the luncheon with copies of his book available at cost. And if you want to sign up for that monthly newsletter, you can do so. I love some of the quotes Doug used to open each chapter. I'll read just one before I turn it over, by Karl von Clausewitz, the noted Prussian military strategist of the early 1800s, who focused on the moral and political aspects of war. The first, the supreme, the most far-reaching act of judgment that the statesman and commander have to make is to establish the kind of war on which they are embarking, neither taking it for nor trying to turn it into something that is alien to its nature. This is the first of all strategic questions and the most comprehensive. I'll now ask Dr. Douglas Johnson to come up and tell you about his unique and fascinating work.
Thank you, Pete. I must say that it's a great privilege to be here to address the Forum Club. I've heard about you for quite some time. It's also a singular honor to be introduced by the likes of Peter Boss. He and his wife, Cecil, are probably one of the brighter couples you'll ever meet. And in addition to his time in the nuclear submarine service, he also captained the 1960 Navy Olympic crew team. So I think we should give Pete a hand for his service. Gotcha. Just to give you a little bit of strategic backdrop about what I'm going to be addressing today, which is faith-based diplomacy. For probably close to 30 years, defense planners in the Pentagon have been wrestling with what they call the asymmetric threat. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with that term, all it means is an attack by creative or unconventional means that a disadvantaged opponent will use against a more powerful adversary, such as bin Laden used on 9/11 to rock our country back on its heels. And in response to that, the planners came up with a new concept called irregular warfare. This was several years ago, which calls for a much tighter integration of defense, diplomacy, and development, which is all to the good. But I maintain there's not enough money in Western treasuries to protect any country against the full spectrum of possible asymmetric threats. And that what you really need is an asymmetric counter, one that deals with the ideas behind the guns. Now, that sounds like a reasonably straightforward proposition, but it's made more difficult by the religious nature of those ideas. Not good news for the United States, because, as has been amply clear from our involvements in Iraq and Afghanistan, we have very little ability to deal with religious differences in a hostile setting, nor do we have any ability to counter demagogues like bin Laden or Milosevic before him, who manipulate religion for their own purposes. So, this presents us with a challenge. Now, I find it supremely ironic that here we are, one of the most religious countries on the face of the planet, and we're having such difficulty dealing with these religious imperatives that permeate today's geopolitical landscape. There are a number of reasons for that, but three seem to stand out. One, which Pete alluded to, is that we've used our separation of church and state as an excuse for not doing our homework to understand how religion informs the worldviews and political aspirations of others who do not similarly separate the two. Second has been our long-held commitment to the rational actor model of decision-making, which has dominated our practice of international relations for as long as I can remember. And two, in defense of that, this rational actor model does not take into account non-rational factors like religion. But when you think about, in the wake of World War II, our overriding task was to contain the godless Soviet Union, which we did a pretty good job of, but religion was not at the table. And it never has been, for as far as I can tell. So we simply don't know how to deal with it. And third are the political ambiguities surrounding our separation of church and state that caused many of our political and military leaders, intimidates them from dealing with the religious dimensions of the threats that they're having to face out there. So in effect, we're operating with one hand tied behind our backs. When you take all this into account, and add to it this looming specter of religious extremism married to weapons of mass destruction, just makes all the more urgent the need to fill this gap in U.S. Decision making. And one approach, a new form of engagement that has shown unusual promise, is this business of faith-based diplomacy. Now, what does that mean? Well, at the macro level, it means simply incorporating religious considerations into our practice of international politics. On the micro level, it means actually making religion part of the solution in some of these intractable identity-based conflicts, like ethnic conflict, tribal warfare, this sort of thing, that typically escape the grasp of traditional diplomacy. And this incorporation of religious reconciliation in the heart of that, if you can make it work, really shows more promise. Now, if you would like to read more about it, you can do so in this book that that Pete mentioned, Religion, Terror, and Error. It goes into it in some depth, and I just would like to... this book, by the way, is a how-to book. When the first book came out in 94, and it sort of criticized the Foreign Service for this blind spot. And then I look at it 15 years later, and I see we still have the same blind spot, even though they confess to having it. I concluded that either they don't want to fill it, or they don't know how. So giving them the benefit of the doubt, not knowing how, that's what this book was, the how-to book. How to incorporate religious considerations into the practice of U.S. foreign policy. How to move to a new process that takes you beyond the rational actor model to a process that incorporates considerations of non-rational factors like religion and non-state actors. and also how to move to a new leadership paradigm that will probably serve the United States better in the multipolar world that awaits us. And if I had to give that a bumper sticker characterization, it would be servant leadership at the international level, where you lead more by example than by force. Now, I'd like to read from the foreword that Pete mentioned by General Anthony Zinni. Zinni was the commander of CENTCOM, which had been fighting all our wars over there, but he was also the U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East. And here's what he says about the book. He says, "This is a visionary approach that goes beyond the whole of government effort and which expands the current definition of smart power. From my two decades of experience in the Islamic world, I am convinced that the vast majority of Muslims would embrace this approach as a means of clearly expressing their beliefs and enabling them to understand ours." So one of the things the book does is it takes a hard look at the existing resources we have and how they might be more usefully redirected to dealing with the problem we're talking about, and then looking at what else needs to be added. And so among the current capabilities are our military chaplains, NGOs like our own, probably foremost among all is the American Muslim community, and I can get into that in some depth if we have time. But in terms of new capabilities that would be required, one is a realignment of the executive branch, particularly the State Department, and one of the things that we call for in the book is the establishment of a new position in the Foreign Service called religion attaché. Now, you would only position a religion attaché in those countries where religion has particular salience, Saudi Arabia or Israel, you name it. But we concluded that a cadre of as few as 30 of these folks could cover our global interests. And what it would do is it would place within the embassy a capability to deal with these complex religious issues that typically get pushed aside by more pressing business, often because they're too difficult to deal with. It's typically now either the cultural affairs officer, the political officer, or the ambassador, him or herself, deals with them, but not adequately. The naysayers will tell you that the quickest way to marginalize something is to create a specialty for it. I understand that, but if you were to take these people and put them in the political section, just as our political military officers are in embassy staffs, and dealing with the issues the same way, it could work. It really could work. Other things we need to do, addressing the political ambiguities, is pretty straightforward. All the president would have to do is task his Justice Department with making the policy brief for why our religious engagement will be a component of U.S. foreign policy in the future, and then getting top-level bipartisan endorsement on Capitol Hill could be done. We could operationalize the whole business of conflict prevention by forming conflict prevention research teams consisting of the right kinds of disciplines, all civilians, that go into trouble spots where things are starting to heat up, and we can figure out what to do to nip it in the bud before it gets too carried away. And the final thing it treats is something called organic suasion. And this is sort of building peace from within. And what I'd like to do is just illustrate that a little bit for you by talking about what Pete mentioned with respect to our work with the madrasas in Pakistan. Now, few of us in the West are mindful of the illustrious history of these religious schools. Because back in the Middle Ages, they were without peer as institutions of higher learning in the world at the time. It was only European exposure to them that led to the creation of our own university system in the West. And you would be amazed at how many of the traditions and mores of academia trace their roots to the madrasas, from the mortar boards and tassels you wear at graduation to funding a chair in a given discipline. The list goes on, and it shouldn't be a surprise because they were the model. But now, when you look in the papers, all you see, you perceive them to be as seedbeds of terrorism, and that's a gross oversimplification. Unfortunately, in reaction to British colonialism, where the Brits were trying to secularize these institutions, They were fearful of losing their Muslim identity, so they purged themselves of all disciplines and subjects that were either Western or secular in nature, to the point where the vast majority of them today are about rote memorization of the Quran and the study of Islamic principles. And our goals there have been twofold. One is to expand the curriculums, include the physical and social sciences, but with a very strong emphasis on religious tolerance and human rights. Second, and Pete mentioned this, and this is very important, is transforming the pedagogy to create critical thinking skills among the students. You find in these tradition-bound tribal cultures, there's not a whole lot of room for creative thinking. So we're talking about a blank slate here, and that's what we're... I'll tell you exactly why it's so important, too, because now, typically, these kids graduate from the school, and along comes a local militant to recruit them to their cause, and they have no ability to question or to challenge. They just go do what they're asked to do. So this is, it's important to build up that capability, I think. Now, at this point, at the point where we concluded our effort with that, which was a few years ago, we had reached some 2,700 madrasa leaders from 1,600 different madrasas. Sounds like a lot. It's not. There's over 20,000 madrasas. But all the ones we did were in the most critical, radical areas. So we feel very confident this could go to scale and take in the whole country. Now, we enjoyed great success, in marked contrast to everyone else's failure who preceded us, including the government of Pakistan. And there were several reasons for the success that I think are worth noting. First is ownership. We conducted the project in such a way that the madrasa leaders felt it was their reform effort and not something imposed from the outside. And incidentally, over there, we never used the word reform. We used the word enhance. And because of their history, it makes a lot of sense. But as I mentioned before, if you believe what you read in the newspapers, you think that these are a caveman mentality with a terrorist outreach. What I'd like to do is to just challenge you to think a little more expansively than that. It turns out that a lot of these folks are very thoughtful, and so ownership was a big piece, and that means that the madrasa leaders had a great deal to say about the change process. And I just want to illustrate the quality of the thinking, if you will. This is the first paragraph of our teacher awareness module in the workshops we were conducting. This was crafted by a madrasa leader. He says, "I have come to a frightening conclusion that I am the decisive element in the classroom. My personal approach creates the climate. My daily mood makes the weather. As a teacher, I have a tremendous power to make a child's life miserable or joyous. I can be a tool of torture or an instrument of inspiration. I can humiliate or humor, hurt or heal. In all situations, it's my response that decides whether a crisis will be escalated or de-escalated and a child humanized or dehumanized." Pretty powerful stuff, and I would be hard-pressed to come up with something half that good. But this is the kind of, the mindset we're working with. The second reason is inspiring them with their own heritage, not just of their schools, which I already mentioned, but going back to the early days of Islam, when so many of the pioneering breakthroughs in the arts and sciences took place under Islam, including religious tolerance at a time when Christianity was woefully intolerant. And the more we talk about this, the taller they walk, and the more they start thinking, hey, maybe we can do better too. And finally, I think the probably the most telling reason for success is that we ground all suggested change in Islamic principles so they can feel they're becoming better Muslims in the process. And in many respects, they are. So those are kind of the reasons for success. Now, let me share a couple of, there are countless anecdotes. Let me share two with you to give you a feel for this. In one of our workshops, one of the participants was a Taliban commander of some renown. He was despondent. He lost two sons in the fighting. He says, "We don't know what America wants. You come after us with guns, we've got no recourse but to respond in kind." So this led to an invitation for me to come to the mountains to tell their senior leadership what America wants, which I did 2 months later. In the meantime, I made the rounds of state, defense, and the agency to make sure that whatever I said was consistent with U.S. policy. And I'm just here to tell you, it's not only the Afghans in the mountains that don't know what America wants, but anyway, 2 months later, I'm up in the mountains. It's in the Malakand Agency in the northwest frontier. It's right across from the Afghan province of Nuristan. And there's 57 Taliban commanders and several tribal and religious leaders. And I start out by telling them, look, I said, we're not a government organization, nor have we received any money from our government, which was true at that time. I said, and why we're here is to see if we can build upon religious values that we share in common to come up with a confidence-building measure that could point toward peace. But for you to be able to do that, you need to understand the Western perspective on what's taking place here. So I gave them what America wants, which simply put was to lay down their arms, distance themselves from Al-Qaeda, and to reconcile with the Karzai government. And then we got into about 2.5 hours of dialogue. A lot of venting went on, as you might imagine. And in the course of that, a number of penetrating questions emerged. One was, what do the American people want? And I breathed a sigh of relief with that because it meant they were still cutting us some slack, despite the fact that we had reelected the administration that was causing all their problems. And I said, well, the American people simply want peace in the region with democratically stable governments in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then they wanted to know why we were attacking Islam. And I said, well, not attacking Islam. That should be apparent from past U.S. interventions in Bosnia, Kosovo, Somalia, Kuwait. I said, left untold, in most tellings of Somalia are the more than 1,500 Somali lives that were saved as a result of the humanitarian aspects of that intervention. Then they wanted to know why we attacked Afghanistan. I said, well, to put it in terms that you hold dear, hospitality, loyalty, and revenge, before we recognize certain members of Al-Qaeda as a threat, we welcomed them into our country, we gave them hospitality, then on 9/11 they struck without warning. We wanted revenge, so we asked the Taliban government to turn over the Al-Qaeda leadership so we could bring them to justice. They refused, so we attacked. I said, but we did so with a heavy heart, because most Americans have great admiration and respect for the Afghan people, growing from our common struggle against the former Soviet Union. And I said, furthermore, it's important for you to recognize that some of your tribal leaders are now banding together against Al-Qaeda because they have violated your hospitality. And they wanted to know why we attacked Iraq. And I sort of punted on that one. I took a little license. I said, well, a good deal of debate about that, but as far as I was concerned, that too was a matter of revenge because Saddam Hussein had attempted to assassinate an American president. And the final question was, why do we have a relationship with Israel? Why do we support Israel? And I didn't really answer that one either. I said we have a strategic relationship with them that is not going to change anytime soon, but what is going to change is the fact that we now are listening more carefully to, have sympathy for, and compassion for the Palestinian people, and over time that's going to make a difference. So then we broke for prayer, went into a smaller group, came up with a confidence-building measure. But in the meantime, in the course of that 2.5 hours, I later learned that some of these folks were Al-Qaeda, and I was glad I didn't know it at the time. But one very rough-looking guy stands up, he points his finger at me, and he says, I can't talk to you unless you become a Muslim. And I thought for a second, I said, don't see a problem. Muslim means submission to God. We all submit to God, therefore we're all Muslims. Everybody laughed and we went on with our business. And, only later did I learn from our project director and our Wahhabi indigenous partner who had spent the better part of a month rounding these folks up that they got very uptight at that point in time because the scenario is you convert or you die. And of course I was totally oblivious to that and I thought, well, the Lord really does look out for fools and incompetents. So Anyway, we did come up with a consensus building measure. It called for establishing a secure zone in the western third of this Afghan province across the way. Most all these folks were Afghans, by the way. And I was unable to sell it to NATO. We were going to try to facilitate direct development because they were all mortified that despite the billions of dollars flowing into the country, none were making it to the village level. So that conscience building measure did not succeed, but where it had a payoff was several months later when the Korean ambassador to the United States called me and asked if there was anything that we could do to help secure the release of the 21 Korean missionaries that were being held hostage by the Taliban. This was in 2007. And because of the networking associated with that earlier trip into the mountains, we were able to, working through that, to really bring religious pressure to bear in a very major way, and I played an instrumental role in getting those folks released. It also was, you have to sit down, Peter, this is entirely too soon. But one of the other ingredients in that was the fact that a fellow by the name of Maulana Samuel Huck, who's the father of the Taliban, we'd been able to help him take the initiative to write a letter on behalf of the letting these missionaries go, and that was helpful too. I was there just a week ago, actually a week and a half ago, spending several hours with him, and he had just told me that he had just written a letter to Boko Haram urging them to let the young girls go that they had captured. So he continues to have quite a large influence with folks that are on the other side of the issue most of the time. Let me just close this out by saying that we did a lot of systemic things too. We took the National Madrasa Oversight Board down to Egypt and Turkey to see how they deal with Islamic education. They went with an attitude, thinking, what can these seculars teach us religious purists? And they came back very humbled because they found that those students there not only handled religious questions every bit as ably as any Pakistani madrasa student, but they also could handle contemporary problems, you know, math, science, this sort of thing. And so they levied a requirement that henceforth all madrasa faculty will be certified. And we have five universities now involved in training madrasa faculty to certify them. So you just don't know where this is going to go. And there was a point we reached 3 years ago where it became clear that the extremists had us so targeted. They put out a 7-page online jihadist journal article that went to all the cells in Pakistan and Afghanistan, specifically targeting our work. So and the good news was we were having an impact. The bad news is we were having an impact. And so what we did was 2 years earlier, we put in place the legal framework for an indigenous NGO that we would one day pass the baton to, because our job is always to work ourselves out of a job by creating capacity, not dependency. So we staffed that up, let our project director go, made him the president of that, and we effectively severed the American tie. And the beat has gone on, and those numbers I gave you before of 2,700 and 1,600 are now 4,500 and 2,500. So that strategy has paid off. The last thing I'd like to make is that just about the time when we were going indigenous, our embassy in Islamabad had not been supporting our work. And we never knew why, whether it was church-state issues or whether it was just politically too hot for them to handle supporting something that had Americans messing around with Pakistani religious schools. But at the end, a contingent came over from State Department, sat down with us and said, "We want to build our strategy around your work." And I thought, hallelujah. Because what had happened is State Department finally figured out that what we were doing by dealing with the ideas behind the guns was every bit as strategic as anything else that was taking place on or off the battlefield. And frankly, if you want to drain the swamp of extremism, you don't do it with the bombs and the bullets. They have their place. But that spawns more terrorists. If you can win hearts and minds that becomes contagious. And I think that's our great hope for the future. So I'm getting the hook. I have so much more to tell you, but maybe we can get it in the question and answer. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. As usual, we have far more questions than could possibly be answered. The first one is, does the Islamic faith allow for cooperation with any other faiths?
It does allow for cooperation, and that's a part of this religious tolerance that we were emphasizing with the madrasas. Kind of depends on how far you take the word cooperation, but certainly tolerance is one piece of it. But what we try to emphasize is getting beyond tolerance to respect, try to show respect for the values that others have, and wonderful anecdotes that shows how that works in a real big way. I'm now at the point where I think that beyond respect, we really need to get to empathy. Try to put on the other person's hat and anticipate how the wounds of history, how all the things that have happened in to the group to which this person belongs, weigh on them in their decision making. I think once you do that, it's very consistent with Sun Tzu's admonition of many years ago, one of the four military strategists, know thine enemy. This is how to know him. And I think we can do a lot better if we do our homework.
I have a related question. How do we get moderate Muslims to confront radical Muslims?
That's a good question. You know, where are the moderates in all this? Quite honestly, there are a number of factors at play in that. First of all, no Muslim likes to be called moderate. And I think a devout Christian would not want to be called a moderate Christian either. So we use the term mainstream. But the fact of the matter is there's a lot of fear out there. There is a lot of playback from the mainstream. There are more fatwas issued by American imams than I can count. And if you do your Google search, you'll find that there's an awful lot out there. But it doesn't make news. It doesn't make news. The only way they can make news is if they pay to have a page in the newspaper and this sort of thing. So a lot more is going on than we're aware of. And I will say this too. Moderates don't have a whole lot of credibility with the extremists. And what we're trying to do with our center and the work we're doing right now is seeing how we can engage the hardcore conservative, nonviolent elements in trying to marginalize, if not directly counter, the violent streams of the same conservative circles.
I have a question from one of the students. How has your experience in the U.S. Navy influenced your policies and methods to handle foreign relations?
I think that the impact of the Navy training is probably a bit indirect, and it really has to do with leadership and how you get the most out of people. And we certainly, in the work we do, it's very dicey, it's quite dangerous, very sensitive, and it calls for everybody watching out for everyone else when we're involved in it. And that's kind of the same approach you have, like in a nuclear submarine, as you well know, Pete. If you're running the power plant and something goes wrong, if your sailors out there aren't taking the initiative to pull your bacon out of the fire, you're probably going to end up in a pretty dire situation. So I think it's through the whole business of leadership and how you inspire people to look beyond themselves, reach beyond themselves.
Another question from one of the students. When you were in high school, how did you see your future?
Well, when I was a sophomore in high school, we had a substitute teacher in world history class one day who was a retired Navy captain, and he brought his Annapolis yearbook to class, and I took one look, I said, that's where I'm going, and I didn't look back. So I was aspiring to become the chief of naval operations, I think. in high school.
To what degree do you think President Obama's refusal to acknowledge Islam as the source of extremist terrorism is handicapping our response? And why do you think he refuses to acknowledge that Christians are specifically being targeted by terrorists?
Well, that's a two-part question. I think his first, the reluctance that he shares and has shared for quite some time of putting the Islamic label on it is it's important to not unwittingly expand the pool of folks that you're going to be contesting with. Islam is a religion of over a billion people, and we don't want to take on a billion people. You know, I think it's important to keep it as narrowly circumscribed as you can. There's another aspect too, and this was there was some concern at the National Prayer Breakfast when Obama was talking about, you know, nobody has totally clean hands in this, and he made reference to the Crusades and what went on in the Spanish Inquisition, and there are, you can go all the way currently to the Ku Klux Klan. There are extremists in every religion, and you know the challenge for all of us is to impress upon our religion sticking to their roots, which are about neighborly concern and the betterment of humanity, and not let it get hijacked, if you will, or co-opted by power politics and manipulated for religious purposes. So I think that President Obama is trying to walk a very delicate line there, and it's a tough line because we all see it through our own prism, and that prism has a kind of an Islamic label on it these days. But if you were to look at Sri Lanka, for example, you would find some atrocities there that just are mind-boggling, all in the name of Buddhism, which is the most specific of all the religions. So, again, I think it's there's scripture about, you know, the plank in your own eye when you're defining the splinter in someone else's. And it's also, I think, important to look at the full sweep of history of what's going on in Islam. Right now, you essentially have a civil war between the Sunnis and the Shias. I think it's critically important that the U.S. not let itself get involved right in the middle of that. And at the moment, I fear that we are.
We have time for just two more. This is a very specific one. Are girls being educated in the madrasa schools? If not, how can you reach or help them?
Girls are being educated in the madrasa schools. Some of the madrasas, like, you'll have 7,000 students, maybe 500 will be girls. They're treated in separately. And one thing that's kind of interesting is that when we started our work in Pakistan, the female leaders of the girls' madrasas approached us to do for them what we were doing for the male madrasas. But the men, Pakistani madrasa leaders, would have nothing to do with that, so we didn't do it. But after 3 years, the men started asking us for, you know, to do the women's madrasas the same way. I guess the pillow talk had taken over in that time, but at any rate, we've been doing the girls' madrasas, and as you might expect, the women get it twice as fast as the men do. And I think one woman said something like, you know, you can deal with the male madrasas till the cows come home, but if you want change, talk to us. We control them. And I thought, well, some things are the same the world over, you know.
All right, here's the final question. Is there any one potential presidential candidate who buys into your approach?
No. I don't know. Can I close with just one last little anecdote?
You
can. I just want to give you one more illustration of this ideas behind the guns. You may remember back in when the Taliban had taken over the Swat Valley, which is kind of a resort area in the mountains of Pakistan, and heads were rolling all over the place. And we were conducting a workshop for 16 madrasas surrounding the Swat Valley. Towards the end of the workshop, a gentleman stood up who was a madrasa leader, but he was also a commander in Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is the terrorist group that brought the attacks on Mumbai. And he stood up and he said, you know, I came here for one reason and one reason only. And that is to discredit everything you have to say. He says, but now, for the first time in my life, I feel like I have sensed the soul of the Holy Quran. And I'm standing here full of rage because for 26 years I have studied and taught the Quran the way it was taught to me. He says, I now see that the right way to advance Islam is through peace, not through conflict. I'm going to change what I teach my students and I'm going to tell them why. Well, this was typical of the courage these folks show. I mean, that's a very brave thing to say in mixed company in that kind of a setting. I suppose they cut him some slack because he was a terrorist leader. But a month later, we came back, and he was doing exactly as he said. And we had a CNN team with us. They'd been after us for several years to capture some of our work. And he said it on CNN for God and the entire world to hear. After it was over, he said, enough, enough. I think he got on. But this is a point. Here's somebody who's a terrorist commander, been studying the Holy Quran for 26 years, and all of a sudden his eyes are open. You see this whole thing of the ideas behind the guns. It's so important, so important. Anyway, thank you, Pete. Thank you all.
Thank you. We didn't get to a lot.